It's time to talk about decolonising Australia. Join me, Rima Ratan, as I ask First Nations Australians about how they are decolonising and what settlers can do to help. Decolonising Australia, Monday nights at 6 p.m. on 3CR.
We gathered at the 2017 National Constitutional Convention, coming from all points of the southern sky, make this statement from the heart. Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes are the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent island, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This our ancestors did according to the reckoning of our culture from the creation, according to the common law from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago. This sovereignty is a spiritual notion, the ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom, remain attached thereto, and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished, and coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. How could it be otherwise, that a people's possessed the land for 60 millennia, and this sacred link disappears from world history in merely the last 200 years? With substantive constitutional change, structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood. Proportionately, we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. We are not an innately criminal people. Our children are alien from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. These dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is a torment of our powerlessness. We seek constitutional change to empower our people and take a rightful place in our own country. When we have power over our own destiny, our children will flourish, they will walk into worlds, and their culture will be a gift to their country. We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. Makarrata is the culmination of our agenda, the coming together after a struggle. It captures our aspirations for a fair and truthful relationship with the people of Australia and a better future for our children based on justice and self-determination. We seek a Makarrata Commission to supervise a process of agreement-making between governments and First Nations and truth-telling about our history. In 1967, we were counted. In 2017, we seek to be heard. We leave base camp and start our trek across this vast country. We invite you to walk with us in a movement of the Australian people for a better future.
That was Thomas Mayer reciting the Uluru Statement from the Heart. We'll hear more from Thomas shortly, but first, welcome to Decolonising Australia, a three-part summer special on 3CR. Over the next 3 weeks, I'll be talking to First Nations Australians about their efforts towards decolonising and seek advice about what the rest of us can do to help. We start with a conversation with Thomas Mayer, author of the book Finding the Heart of the Nation, and much more. Thomas spoke to me a couple of weeks ago over the phone from Darwin, where he's based. I started our conversation by asking him to introduce himself and tell me about his work and involvement in the creation of the Uluru Statement from the Heart.
So I'm a Torres Strait Islander. I was born on and have always lived on Larrakia land in Darwin. And I became a wharfie at a young age. I was 17 years old and worked on the wharves for 16 years before I became a leader of the union and elected leader of the Maritime Union of Australia. And as a wharfie and as a delegate on the wharves and then an official of the union, I learnt a lot about the value of unity and also the value of society working together. So as wharfies, as a union, not using that leverage just for our own, you know, the leverage of unity and the power that we build just for our own wages and conditions, but also to support those in society that are struggling the most, you know, social justice issues. And of course, as a Torres Strait Islander, I was most passionate about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues. So as an official, I was able to take more of a lead with the support of the membership on our issues and organise the rallies and the various actions around the awful decisions that politicians have made in Indigenous affairs, such as the intervention and the way that children were treated in detention in Don Dale. And so with all of that background, I realised that there was something missing from our advocacy. You know, our actions on the street were reactive. We never had a really had a coherent message on the solutions that we wanted. I began to realise just how deeply divided our people were, purposely and tactically divided by companies and governments, anyone with an interest in exploiting our land, and then became involved in a constitutional dialogue. I was invited to the Constitutional Darwin Dialogue and had a bit to say in there, and that's how I got involved in this. I went to Uluru, elected from the Darwin Dialogue, and realised that what we came up with at Uluru was not only unprecedented after the process that had been undertaken, but was also powerful in that it was achievable, reasonable, yet able to give us the means to change our plight, and simply through voice treaty truth, the setting up a representative body that could enable First Nations to come together and have our discussions and reach consensus and go out there and effectively campaign and change the plight that we're in. That's how I became involved. It's a bit of a long story.
How did that result in your book, Finding the Heart of the Nation?
After Uluru, the politicians immediately walked away from it. Barnaby Joyce lied and labelled it a third chamber of parliament. The Prime Minister at the time soon followed, Malcolm Turnbull, and despite all the rhetoric about wanting to do things with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, not for them, they pretty quickly tried to dismiss what we had achieved at Uluru and rejected those proposals, and particularly the proposal for a constitutionally enshrined voice. We didn't take no for an answer, so I started to travel the country with the support of my union, seconded to the movement, to the cause by the union, and they paid for my salary and my flights and accommodation for around 18 months, and I started to build a people's movement with other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders around this issue. And on the way, I realised that one of the best ways I could move people to join the campaign was to write a book and share with them the experiences that I'd had in that time of travelling the country with the Uluru Statement, and mainly help people to hear Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voices that they may never hear from otherwise. And so that's why I set about writing the book.
They are such powerful voices, and they are significant voices. They are people who are activists or who've been involved, who've done significant things for First Nations communities, and yet we're not likely to hear about them. Why do you think that is?
Oh, I think that that's because we're only 3% of the population, and our issues are not on the radar of our democracy, to be straight. Our democracy doesn't force us to face those awful statistics. I mean, it's in the news from time to time, but it's not the issue that people vote on. It doesn't move politicians. They've got their own careers and their own wants to be elected again and their own feathering of their own nest, to be straight. And Indigenous issues, you know, only 3% of the population and less than that 3% actually engage in our democracy through voting because of impoverishment or because of the places that we live, you know, living remotely. It just doesn't move people to take notice of us and our issues.
It feels like there is unfinished business in Australia with acknowledging the history of what happened with First Nation people, the horror of what settlement wrought, basically, on the 100% occupied continent.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, when I talk about the flawed democracy, that's what the intent of the constitutionally enshrined First Nations voice is, you know, is to enhance our voice. We were excluded from decision-making in this country in 1901 when the Constitution was enacted. We were excluded from those constitutional dialogues as a dying race. That was what people said about us, those old white men that determined what the constitution of our federation would be. No woman. They determined that we would be a dying race and totally excluded us.
And set about ensuring that this was a dying race.
Yes, they set about ensuring it. You know, the policies and the legislation, the assimilation policy. Well after 1901, there were massacres, so genocide continued. And even today, we are seeing children stolen in a system that does not actually take proper regard of what has been perpetrated against our people and how that has damaged our social fabric.
Why is it important to have a voice in the Constitution?
Well, it's important because we need to have the power to affect the decisions that are made about us. As I said, in a democracy where we're less than 3% engaged in this, you know, the decision-making of this nation, we need an enhanced voice. We need a constitutional right to have a say on the issues that affect us. So the voice is absolutely vital to that, and it's also about us being able to come together as many First Nations, because we're not, you know, one Aboriginal or one Torres Strait Islander people. There are many First Nations on this continent and its adjacent islands. And every time we have built a strong representative body, the government has destroyed it. And so it's very much about unity, us being able to choose our representatives again and them being able to come together, have the debate, reach a consensus, and then go and pursue what we need for our people. And the constitutional enshrinement is absolutely vital to that. It's important that listeners understand that legislating this voice will set us up to fail. We must fight for the constitutional reform because a legislated voice is too easily repealed. And so we've got to put it in the rule book to put it out of the reach of a hostile government.
But the Constitution, as you say, it excludes, but there's a race power. Did you want to talk about that? Because it sort of seems to allow special laws to be made for Indigenous people.
That's right. So, while we're only 3% of the population and Parliament doesn't represent us, Parliament has the constitutional power to make special laws about us. about a race of people, and it's only been used to make special laws for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And often those laws, those decisions have been detrimental to our people, have been damaging, have taken us back every time that we have tried to advance. So the race power was also very well considered in all of the dialogues and at Uluru itself, the National Constitutional Convention. We didn't call to get rid of the race power, and that's because the race power that has been proposed before, and it has been problematic, as in the lack of support from people and parliamentarians, but also because the race power, that power to make special laws, is to make some beneficial laws, arguably, like native title, laws that have benefited our people. Another aspect of the race power is it has been considered about amending the race power to make beneficial laws for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. But that is also flawed because it would be a reactive judicial power. We would need to wait for a bad decision. That bad decision would need to be taken to the High Court at great cost, and it would take time. And even then, you would be at the mercy of the court system, basically, and the High Court, it's unpredictable what they'll decide. So even with the intervention, which was awful, they might argue that they, would have that emergency response for the benefit of women and children. And while myself and many of my brothers and sisters and colleagues would disagree with that, you still don't know where that would land through the High Court. And so that's why people lent towards not changing the race power or removing it, but actually setting up a political voice that is protected and strong enough and accountable to the communities that is able to affect the decisions before they're made.
You're listening to a three-part summer special on decolonising Australia on 3CR Radical Radio. And I'm talking to Thomas Mayer about the Uluru Statement from the Heart. There have been similar documents before, the 1963 Yirrkala Bark petitions and the 1988 Barunga Statement, which ultimately led to the creation of ATSIC. How is the Uluru Statement from the Heart different?
Yeah, and there's been many others. The Larrakia petition to the Queen, the petition to the King that came out of the Day of Mourning.
That's 1936, isn't it?
Yeah, 1936. Those statements and petitions were all addressed to a king or a queen or parliament. And when we were at the dialogues around the country and then the Uluru National Constitutional Convention, we considered those lessons from the past, how previous statements and petitions had been received and dismissed and promises had been broken. It was a film put together by the world-class filmmaker Rachel Perkins, the daughter of Charlie Perkins, that took us through the history of our struggle. And so the Uluru Statement takes those lessons and actually, instead of putting it to a king or a queen or parliament, it's written to the Australian people because it's so predictable that politicians will ignore what we call for. And so it's really up to us now, the Australian people, to say to the government, you cannot dismiss our call for constitutional enshrinement. We're going to fight for this.
And the process seems to be different in this instance. It's sort of a deeply deliberative democracy type process that led to the statement as well, which would be a little different to what's happened previously. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And when I said unprecedented, that's what I was talking about. There has never been such a well-informed, well-planned, Indigenous-led constitutional dialogue in this country. I mean, it's the most proportionate constitutional dialogue that has ever happened in this entire country's history. It was Professor Megan Davis, a cobble-cobble woman, expert on public law and constitutional law, the first woman elected to a United Nations Permanent Forum, that designed and led it with people like Arnie Pat Anderson. And that cannot be ignored, that this process was so truly national. It had a formula, 100 participants, 60% traditional owners was part of that formula.
The book is really about creating a people's movement. Why is that important?
Because the politicians are very, very comfortable in the status quo. They have no urgency to act on empowering Indigenous people and they don't want to be held accountable. And so really the only people that can change their minds is us. It's the people that elect them. And so that's why we need people to be writing to the politicians and visiting their offices and doing everything that they can to move those politicians from that comfortable status quo and put the question to the people. The proposal was to the Australian people and it requires Parliament to take it to a referendum. It's not an easy task, referendum, and we're not naive enough to think that's going to be easy. So, I mean, firstly, we need a people's movement to shift those politicians from that comfortable status quo, to have the courage to put it to the Australian people, to provide the resources that it takes to take it to the Australian people and make sure that it's explained properly. And then we'll need a massive campaign, of people door knocking and people having conversations and encouraging each other to vote yes when the time comes. Now, that is what a people's movement is required for. I mean, 1967 came from a people's movement. Now, it took quite a significant campaign. It was at least a decade of campaigning before that overwhelming success in 1967, more than 90% of the population saying yes. And we can replicate that, but we do need the people's movement.
In your book, you note that Professor Pat Anderson said after a meeting with politicians on June 30th, 2017, this is only a month or so after the Uluru Statement is made public, the main obstacle to its adoption would not come from the Australian people but from our politicians. Now, you've said the politicians obviously are happy with the status quo. How much receptivity have you found in the population?
Oh, it's been wonderful support. You know, I've travelled endlessly since May 2017, taking the Uluru Statement to the people, and everywhere that I've gone, it has been huge support. And, you know, when you take the time to explain it to people, they support it. They wonder, well, you know, why can't we have this put to us, and why can't we say yes to a constitutionally enshrined voice? It's time. We are ready for this. I'm very confident that we can win a referendum on this.
A lot of this show is really about asking Indigenous Australians who are involved in almost a decolonising movement. What is it that people like me, I'm a migrant, I'm a woman of Indian extraction who was born and grew up in Fiji, who moved here. What can I do in particular?
Well, you're using your platform on radio to help us get the message out there. That's something that's really great. I'd love it if that was able to continue to keep people updated. But also we need to start these little community groups and supporters groups in these different areas. So we need one in every suburb. We need one in every town, even if it's a street-based supporter group. We need people to meet regularly, talk about what the next action will be, and not feel like any action is too small to take, because every action adds up. I mean, to date, it's been an unresourced campaign. Us Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders coming out of Uluru did not have any money to go and take it to the people. As I said, I did it with the support of the union movement, and others did it, you know, in their spare time, with what resources they could scrape up. But we have managed to keep this on the radar. We've managed to shift the government to a certain point to accept that we need a voice. They're still not accepting constitutional enshrinement. But that has been successful. All of these little actions in the last couple of years have been successful in moving us this far, and that will need to continue to grow, though. So every action counts.
One of the things that struck me about the book was that during the actual convention at Uluru, it sort of seemed to go less than ideal on the second day or something, but people you spoke to would repeatedly say, well, you can't get 100% agreement among hundreds of people. I guess what I'm trying to reach to is there's this sense that we don't all have to agree as long as we're working towards something together.
I mean, it's human nature that, you know, a group of almost 300 people talking about the rule book of the nation, the Constitution, no less, are going to have differences of opinions and that factions will emerge. But it was only around 20 people that walked out of 270. And it was an overwhelming endorsement of the Uluru Statement. And it was a consensus that cannot be ignored now, you know, after an unprecedented national process, well-informed, done to a formula, led by Indigenous leaders. And when I was talking about the people already, I really think they are. But it's frustrating when some people say, I really want to support Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but I've heard this Aboriginal person say, I don't support the Uluru Statement. Well, you know, that's not an excuse anymore. I mean, the Uluru Statement is a consensus position from a national dialogue. It reached such a powerful consensus. And if we can't accept that invitation now, then we're not going to do anything. I mean, if we're going to wait for 700,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to be in one room for one convention and walk out of there holding hands all saying yes to one proposed reform, then we're not going to do anything. The Uluru Statement is that invitation now. You know, it came from that consensus, and there's no reinventing the wheel anymore. You know, it's done, and we just got to get out there and fight for it and concentrate on moving the politicians and then moving the rest of the population.
I brought up the disagreement thing because I feel like when people create small groups that you're suggesting they do, like suburb by suburb even, there will be disagreement, but the process of reaching the Uluru Statement provides this amazing template for accepting disagreement.
Yeah, it does. It's full of truth-telling in itself, you know. It
proposes an ancient way of uniting this nation, you know, a way that isn't ancient, actually, because it still exists today. You know, it is coming from the oldest culture in the world. The Makarrata is a Yolngu word for the coming together after a struggle. It is actually a process. Now come with the truth and be prepared to reach an agreement and then walk out of there with a better relationship than what you started with. That's basically Makarrata. That's what we're proposing.
There's a history of the union movement being involved in First Nation affairs. Do you want to make a comment about that based on the support you've received?
Well, something that makes me really proud to be a unionist is that when I was, you know, on the wharf and learning about the union movement from my young days was just all those other things that our union movement had done, not just for our own wages and conditions, you know, so supporting the Gurindji Wavehill walk-off, the Noongarrabah dispute, you know, just to name a couple where union members have walked alongside Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. There's the support for the anti-apartheid campaign. Our seafarers put a ban on any ships to carry oil to the apartheid regime, and which became an international action and put a lot of pressure on them. You know, our part in so many struggles that go beyond, you know, I mean, Medicare. Medicare exists because unions fought for it, you know, a universal health system. And so when, you know, when we consider all of this and the huge amount of support that the MUA has given through supporting me to be a part of this struggle in the last couple of years, and then when we see the way that the Morrison government is attacking unions, I mean, another one, the green bans, you know, the construction workers banning the destruction of buildings that we all enjoy today in our cities and spaces that families and society can enjoy. When the Morrison government is talking about an ensuring integrity bill that would allow a minister to deregister, to destroy our union so easily and basically totally disempower workers, I mean, all of this is at stake, defence of all those things and the advancement of our people. So and these are troubling times, and it's another good sort of reason why, as far as First Nations go, we need to constitutionally enshrine our voice, because, you know, we're not hundreds of thousands of workers that are able to pay membership dues. And so unions are very important to us, and, you know, there's a lot to learn from each other.
You're listening to Decolonising Australia on 3CR, and I've been talking to Thomas Mayer about the Uluru Statement from the Heart and his book, Finding the Heart of the Nation. Mainly we're talking about how settler Australians can help in the people's movement he's building around the statement. We're going out with a song that was written about the Uluru Statement from the Heart, recommended by Thomas. Here's what he had to say about it.
This song is really special to myself and the movement for the constitutional enshrinement of a First Nations voice, the Uluru Statement. One of the first places I took the Uluru Statement to was to the state funeral of Andrew McCutcheon, a former minister in Victorian Parliament, Labor Minister and Councillor of St Kilda. But the reason I took the Uluru Statement to the state funeral for Andrew was that on his deathbed, suffering motor neurone disease, he was so angered and frustrated at Turnbull's dismissal of the Uluru Statement that part of his therapy was to write this song. And one of his dying words were that he would love for this song to go viral. So I'm really happy that it'll be played on radio.
May it go viral.
May it go viral.
There once was a time when the white man denied the black man existed, and we tried to hide him away. The white man invaded the black man's terrain, pretending they owned the whole southern plain, denying a history spanning thousands and thousands of years. Extermination, black children stolen by misguided.
Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. For more information and to donate online, go to 3cr.org.au. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.